குட் ஈவினிங். இன்னைக்கு வந்து வெப் மீட்டிங், லைஃப் டிவைன் வெப் மீட்டிங் தொடங்க இருக்கிறது. அன்னைக்கும் பகவானுக்கும் அப்பா தவ திரு கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதார விந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இந்த நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். நவ் ஐ எம் ஆஸ்கிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி டு ஸ்டார்ட் தி டாபிக்.
Today we're going to talk about the philosophy of rebirth. And to start off, we have just a very brief video about the dawn, which is, Sri Aurobindo starts Savitri with the symbol dawn. That's the first canto of Savitri. And in preparing for this chapter, I was discussing with Appa, and we were talking about Savitri, and I felt that this canto has a good connection, important connection with the chapter we're discussing today. So I thought we could start off. This is just maybe 3-4 minutes. It's only a set of slides with a set of quotations, mostly from Savitri and 2 quotations from the Rig Veda. These slides are supposed to show the rising, the dawn, the beginning of the dawn until it reaches its full splendor. It's just a sequence of 10, 12 slides.
Then something in the inscrutable darkness stirred, insistent, dissatisfied, without a name. Something that wished but knew not how to be, teased the inconscient to wake ignorance. A long, lone line of hesitating hue, like a vague smile tempting a desert heart, troubled the far rim of life's obscure sleep. An eye of deity peered through the dumb deeps, a scout in a reconnaissance from the sun. Its message crept through the reluctant hush, calling the adventure of consciousness and joy. The darkness failed and slipped like a falling cloak from the reclining body of a god. Then, through the pallid rift that seemed at first hardly enough for a trickle from the suns, outpoured the revelation and the flame. Into a far-off nook of heaven there came a slow, miraculous gesture's dim appeal, and beauty and wonder disturbed the fields of God, a wandering hand of pale enchanted light. Spiritual beauty illumining human sight and squanders eternity on a beat of time. Dawn built her aura of magnificent hues. It wrote the lines of a significant myth, telling of a greatness of spiritual dawns, a brilliant code penned with the sky for a page. Dawn divine, shine out immortal in thy car of happy light, sending forth the pleasant voices of the truth. Meet ye the dawn as she shines wide toward you.
If you have not observed really beautiful dawn, at least the slides show you that it's in the right place at the right time from the right observation. The dawn is one of the most spectacular wonders of nature. There's hardly anything that can compare to it in its beauty. And the dawn is not just a beautiful natural phenomenon, it's a symbol. He calls it in Savitri the symbol dawn. But dawn has always been a symbol. From Vedic times, it is a symbol of the mystery of birth and mortality. It's a symbol of the mystery of the universe. It's a symbol of human aspiration. In Vedic times, of course, Dawn was Usha, the daughter of heaven. Usha's a ray of Aditi, the divine mother, the eternal divine mother, the mother of the gods, the eternal light. The dawn is a ray of the infinite consciousness of the mother. The dawn is not just the moment at which the sun rises. It's a magical moment where something reveals itself before the normal light of the day. That's what the images are supposed to show. It's not the normal day coming only. It's a hint of what's coming. It's a hint of what's behind. It's a hint of what's waiting. It's a symbol of the awakening of consciousness. It's a symbol of human destiny. It's a symbol of the spiritual destiny of the universe. In Savitri, he starts off the poem with a long canto, very slowly describing each of the stages in the awakening of consciousness, which he calls the symbol dawn. The first line is, he says, it's the hour before the gods awake. And Mother, in her commentary, she says, he's writing about the moment in the evolution of the universe before the gods have descended, before consciousness has awakened on earth. So this poem is a poem of the universe. It's not just a poem of a story of a Savitri and Satyavan. This is the dawn of the spiritual evolution of the universe. But the poem is also about a unique moment in the history of the earth and of the universe, the hour of God, in which King Aswapati has invoked the Divine Mother to descend on earth, and she has come down as Savitri. And on this particular day on which the poem begins, the line is, this is the day that Satyavan must die. This is the day, this is the hour in which the Divine Mother is coming to liberate the human soul from ignorance and bring about the supermental descent. There's something else about the dawn that's very special. It keeps recurring. It recurs every day. It never stops. We can never imagine a time before there was a dawn. And we can't imagine one unless we believe in the science of the Big Bang, which is all right now just a hypothesis. But anyway, as long as there was an earth and as long as there is an earth, there was a dawn and there will be a dawn. This is something that keeps going on, and each day the dawn carries a promise. It carries a promise of something better and more to come. And that's what life is, and that's what birth is. Dawn is the birth of consciousness every day, the birth of a higher consciousness trying to offering us a promise of what's waiting for us. And the dawn is to remind us that we too have been born and reborn and reborn over and over again, like the dawn, from the beginning of time. And whether we know this day is going to end, but the process of our birth and rebirth and our progress will never end. So dawn is a really appropriate symbol for the process, the human birth, life, death, and rebirth. And in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo says and speaks about rebirth what has never been spoken by any tradition anywhere in the world up until now. He gives the secret meaning of rebirth. I mean, we are filled with all types of stories and impressions and beliefs and superstitions about birth and rebirth and all. But nobody before now has given a really clear picture of what is, why this process, why it is there, what is its meaning, what is its significance. And more importantly than that, why are we born here? What are we here for? What was there before this life for us? What is there after? What comes next? What are we intended to learn or accomplish when we're here on earth? We're getting married, we're earning money, we're building houses, we're getting cars, we may be popular or we may be happy and all. What are we really here for? All of these fundamental questions are raised by this chapter and the two more chapters that come after it. He raises so many questions, and even if we come out of after reading this chapter with the questions and start thinking about them, it would have served a very good purpose. For a long time, Appa has been mentioning the stories of Sherlock Holmes, this brilliant master detective who's able to solve the crimes that no policeman is able to solve. And his arch nemesis, his arch enemy, is this man, Dr. Moriarty, who's an arch criminal, who in many respects is just like Sherlock Holmes, full of energy, very intelligent, very clever, very observant, very knowledgeable, very courageous. Only thing is, whereas Sherlock Holmes is fighting for good and trying to destroy the evil, and Moriarty is the arch evil himself, the Asura. And now we have Detective Sambhu, who is in almost every respect the very opposite of Sherlock Holmes. He's not courageous. He's not intelligent. He's not well informed. Sherlock Holmes gives all the credit for his accomplishments to the police. Sambhu is getting credit for everything and becoming famous. Sherlock Holmes hardly ever gets paid for anything. Sambhu is earning so much of money. I think he was getting 90 rupees or something like that, and now he starts getting hundreds and hundreds of rupees, and eventually he gets a car and a house and a wife and all of this. He's prospering on all sides and becomes famous. Everybody wants him. Where does this difference come from? What makes a Sherlock Holmes or a Dr. Professor Moriarty or a Sambhu? What is the significance? What is the significance of the character and personality with which each of us have developed? Where did it come from? What makes us so different from each other? In the same family, we've got Elizabeth and Jane and Mary and Lydia and Kitty in the very same family. And they are almost as opposite as Sambhu and Sherlock Holmes. What accounts for the... All of these are questions that come up when we try to understand the real significance of birth and rebirth. Rebirth has been in the belief, the ancient beliefs of India, for going way back to Vedic times. But the unusual thing that Sri Aurobindo explains in this chapter is that rebirth is not necessary for the philosophy of Advaita, for Shankara. It's not necessary for Buddhism, both of which came from here, even though they both accept it. It's not consistent. It's not necessary for the philosophies that they have pronounced at all. But for the integral philosophy of Sri Aurobindo, for what Sri Aurobindo says is the real truth of the universe, rebirth is absolutely indispensable. God cannot do without it. Spiritual evolution is not possible without it. Not only our evolution is not possible, the divine evolution is not possible. So in our reading of the chapter, which we are doing through the month, I was wondering, he goes page after page explaining the tradition, the difference between what Shankara said and Buddha said and the Vedas said and the Upanishads say and Christianity says. And I'm wondering, I don't really care about what they're saying. Let him tell us. But then I realized, only when you realize why rebirth is not essential for any of the other views, you really can understand how important it is, how essential it is, how central it is to Sri Aurobindo. And that's what he tells us in this chapter. And you really see, I saw much more clearly than before, how perfect the universe is. In all its complexity and all its mystery, how everything is perfectly integrated and with a central purpose in mind, which Shankara couldn't understand, Buddha didn't understand, because they had their eye only on one goal. As you all know, Appa has said that the life divine is a vision of the whole. It's a horoscope of the universe. And rebirth is a key to unlocking the secrets of the horoscope. This chapter shows us the essential place of the ephemeral individual. Ephemeral means temporary, vanishing. We are here today, gone tomorrow. In the scheme of the universe, we're nothing. We're just a speck in the map of time. The essential place of the individual in the evolution of the eternal being, in the spiritual evolution of the universe, in the becoming of the universe. The individual is essential, and rebirth is essential for the individual to play his role, our role. And this is not a lecture on philosophy. This is supposed to be a personal message from Sri Aurobindo and Mother to us about our lives and the significance of our lives. And the value is not to understand the philosophy of rebirth, but to understand rebirth in terms of our own lives and what we're doing here. I mentioned earlier, most of us, when we gauge our progress in life, we gauge our progress on what we've accomplished socially. What's my status? What's my job? How big is my house? How big is my salary? Who did my children marry? What is the educational level and all of that? And it kind of reminds me when I'm reading Detective Sambhu. Sambhu's constantly paying attention to things that are totally irrelevant. In one of the stories, he's now become very popular, and anybody who can bring Sambhu to his house is a source of prestige. So he's called to some wedding in Madras and very reluctant to go, but the father of the bride insists on him coming. And it turns out the night before the wedding, some 15 sovereign gold chain was stolen. And the father thinks Sambhu is such an important man that he It's not fair to even mention this to him because he's only after the big criminals and all. So he's embarrassed to even mention it, so he doesn't mention it. Sambhu comes to the wedding party, and he's just standing around, and he sees a plate of cashew burfi. And it seems he loves the cashew nut, and he loves this sweet. And he keeps eyeing this sweet, and he forgets everything else. And where can I get a hold of this sweet? And he tries going over to the place, but wherever he goes, people gather around and attend on him. And then the sweet is taken from one house to the other because the function has not yet begun and they're not distributing the sweet. And he goes looking for it there. And wherever he tries to get near the sweet so he can take a piece, somebody comes and interrupts him. Finally, out of desperation, he's not thinking of anything, marriage or anything else. Finally, out of desperation, in the middle of the night, he sneaks downstairs to the room where the burfi is kept. And he grabs a piece. And suddenly, some lady who's a member of the family comes and attacks him and knocks him on the head and puts him down and calls him thief, and he says, I'm not a thief, you're a thief. And it turns out that the gold necklace was buried in the burfi, and she knew it because she has hidden it there. And he finds the gold necklace and becomes a hero. And apart from getting some burfi, finally, he also gets 100 rupees, so a lot of money at that time. He's a hero. I think it's a good description of us because we're going around life looking for the cashew and the burfi and all of that, not knowing what our real purpose is. And somehow by mistake, we find something. We make some progress. I think it's a good description of human nature. And if you think about Mrs. Bennett, you can see in a similar thing is there. Because everything she does, she's running after the burfi, everything she does only causes trouble. In spite of that, the men come, Darcy comes, Bingley comes, Wickham comes, even Collins comes. And in spite of that, three daughters are married. I think it's a good way for us to understand our lives. Our souls means each one of you, each of us, our soul has come here for something. I don't think it was burfi. We don't know what it is. And we're so busy looking at the sweets of the various descriptions that we never stop to ask what it is we have come for, what it is, what's the purpose of being here. Somehow or other, by some mistake, by some stumbling, we get some experience during the life which helps the soul. And I guess that explains why we've had thousands of lives. Because if this is the process, it's going to take a long time. But we're enjoying the sweets, so we don't seem to be in a hurry. And if you look at the other characters in the story, you'll see it's about the same thing. When his soulmate is first presented to him, Darcy says she's tolerable. I'm not going to dance with a woman who's not being not dancing with other men. He should be happy she's not dancing with other men. Instead of that, he abuses her. And she abuses him. So a knowledge of rebirth should really remind us not about what happened in the past life and not about what's going to happen in the future life, but what's happening in this life and what are we doing with this life and why did we come and what's the purpose of it. this chapter raises many fundamental questions which he has discussed elsewhere, but which he now comes back to. Questions that humanity has not yet answered satisfactorily. What happens after death? What happens to us? What were we before we were born? What's the relationship between my body and my consciousness? When my body dies, what happens to that consciousness? If it survives, if there's something that survives death, does it survive just to lead a few more lives and then permanently disappear? How long does it last? How long has this been going on? How many lives have we led? What were we doing all of this time up until now? Because I don't know about you, I still feel pretty ignorant. And if I've gone through all of these births, what did I learn in all of these births? I feel like I'm starting out almost at scratch in many respects. And what am I learning in this birth, and how is the next one going to be different and even better than this one? These are questions he asks. His view, he speaks of spiritual evolution. When I first heard about spiritual evolution, I thought he means each of us is evolving. We're each a spirit, a soul, and we're each evolving. It took a long, long time, about 30, 35 years for me to realize. He says the spiritual evolution, not Gary's evolution. It is the spirit that's evolving. Not just your spirit or my spirit or everybody else's spirit. The spirit, the divine, is evolving. The whole universe is an evolution of the divine. But he also says that each of us is a spirit, or each of us is a portion of that spirit, a soul, a jivatma. Each of us has an evolving portion of that universal transcendent divine, and we too are evolving. And what he's telling us in this chapter is that evolution of the universe and this evolution of us as individuals, it's the same process. We're following the same path. If the universe started off, or if Earth started off as an empty material shell with no life in it, and over billions of years, if we accept the scientists just for the fun of it, over billions of years, life appeared on Earth, and over millions of years, different types of life appeared on Earth, and eventually, after a long, long time of about 4 billion years, human life appeared on Earth. And over the last 50,000 years, human life has been evolving. This is not just the history of the Earth. This is the history of every soul on the Earth. He tells us that we started the way the Earth started. We started as the soul buried in matter. We started as the stone. We started as the fungus, as the fish, and as the plant, and have evolved up individually, because it is through our evolution individually that the divine is evolving in the universe. That process and this process are the same. Rather, they're parts of the same process. In society, somebody achieves something great. Steve Jobs invents an iPad or an iPod or an iPhone, and we all end up getting it after some time, or whatever else the invention is. It is the individual's progress that becomes universal. And that's the role that we each play. Most of us are not inventing iPods and iPhones, but each of us has a unique contribution to play to the evolution of the universe. What is it? What is your contribution? What have you come for? What is that thing that you individually are destined to manifest? What is the divine truth of your being, which is unique? It's unique because the divine is infinite, and the divine wants to infinitely manifest its qualities, and it is trying to do that through the evolution of millions of souls who are portions of the divine, each with a unique spiritual individuality that is awakening and evolving over time. And he tells us, he speaks of involution and evolution. Papa writes about it so often, we've discussed it so many times. If the whole universe is an involution of the spirit as matter into an inconscient, an involution of the infinite consciousness into buried and losing itself in inconscience. And what's true of the whole universe is true of each of us. The spiritual truth of our being is an infinite consciousness, not an infinite ignorance, which sometimes I feel like. The truth is, it's our souls have also buried themselves, involved themselves in the inconscience of material nature, and are gradually evolving out as life, evolving out as animal life, evolving out as human life, and hopefully pretty soon as something more than human life. It is the same process for us individually as it is for the universe. And in that evolution, birth is essential. And in this chapter, he tells us, we may envy the gods and say, why was I end up buying as a human being when I could have been a god and had all of the powers and knowledge and joy of being a god? He tells us, for the soul to make progress, there's an essential condition. You have to be in a physical body. Birth is the only place. Being here in a physical body on earth is the only place where you can make progress. You may, after the life, you may spend a lot of time trying to digest what you've learned, assimilate it before you're born again, but your learning, your progress only comes here in the body. Whereas in many traditions, the Christian traditions, life on earth is a test. God is testing us to see whether we do anything wrong. And for each thing we do wrong, we're going to be punished after death in the purgatory. And if we do too many things wrong, we're going to be punished eternally for what we have done. For Shankara, for Advaita, life is an illusion. It's unreal. And the sooner we wake up from this illusory dream, the better, because we go back to where we were in the first place. Then why we ever got born or fell into this dream is not clear. And what's the meaning of it? In fact, it has no meaning. It's a bad dream, and you better wake up from it and hope that there's only one. And for Buddhism, this is all a cycle of suffering. There's nothing to be gained here except to realize that you're caught in a cycle of suffering based on desire. And when you give up trying to satisfy your desires, when you give up the ego, you can go into peace. You can have a nirvana of peace. Rebirth is not the aim. Rebirth is the punishment. Because you didn't learn your lesson, you have to go and live again and again and again until finally you wake up and give up desire and outgrow the desire, or you outgrow the illusion, Shankara's illusion. You outgrow Maya, and you go to the real place, but it's not really clear why you ever came from there in the first place. Maybe it's for God's amusement. He wants to see how he can create beings and make them suffer. And in Christianity, it gets even more confusing because it seems like we're only born once. And if we're only born once, why are we the way we are? And assuming if we're only born once, and this is the test, why are we like this? Who made us like this? I didn't make myself like this. Who made us each like this? Presumably God made each of us like this. And then he puts us like a toy that winds us up and watches us go around. And then he says, I send you to hell and I give you to heaven and I give you an A plus and you a D minus. And he's grading us each. And then for eternity, for the rest of eternity, we're going to be living by the scorecard of what happens in 70, 80, 90, whatever is our lifespan. Doesn't make any sense. Even a child, I think, could come up with a more meaningful, convincing story. And certainly we have to assume that God is capable of a better invention than this. And then we have the ego. The soul has come here for a progress, but we don't know the soul. The I is the ego. The I is not the soul. The I that I'm living, the thing I'm thinking, feeling, that's identified with who I am. When you call me by my name, I answer. It's the ego that's responding. It's the ego that's taking score and saying, did I get what I want? Have I achieved? Do I have respect of other people? Am I a success? Am I happy? And all of that, which in many ways seems to be totally unrelated with the purpose for which our souls came. And yet Sri Aurobindo tells us that the ego was essential to our progress. Why? Ego, without the ego, we could have never begun the progress. Without being in the body, we could have never begun the progress. But as long as we are in the ego, as long as we're identified with it, our progress is very, very, very limited. Our goal is, everything that Appa writes, everything that Mother and Shri, is to come out of that illusion of the ego and to wake up to our real being, to the psychic being, to our soul. And he tells us in the book that for the surface ego to awaken to the psychic, to our real individuality, and to discover our oneness with all other souls, universal oneness, and to discover our oneness with the spirit, with the pure divine, the transcendent divine, is the process by which we awaken. We evolve in consciousness. Not so we can go to moksha. Even Savitri was offered, the divine offered us what but the paradise beyond earth. After Savitri conquered death, the divine offered Savitri eternal bliss in the heavens above with Satyavan. She said, no, I want here on earth. I want to go back. I want Satyavan here on earth. Our fulfillment, our destiny is here on earth. We want to bring the divine to earth. He says that birth is the first mystery of life, first mystery of the universe. Death is the second mystery. Without death, life would cease to have value for us. There'd be no hurry to do anything. We won't value the days. We won't value the time, except we have this feeling that we've got a limited amount of time to do what we need to do. Death gives us a sense of an urgency. After all, I must have come for some purpose. Am I doing it? Am I doing what I should do? It's not a... So death, in our ignorance, it creates the intensity for us to ask ourselves, why am I alive? Supposing there were no life, there were no birth and death. There's just life. Like the air is always here. We would never think about what's the meaning of it. We ask what's the meaning of it because we know it starts, at least we think it starts, and we think it ends. If it has a beginning and an end, then what are we doing here? There must be a purpose. If it's simply there forever, like space, then we wouldn't even be thinking about it. We would just take it for granted. When we say something was born, it means there was something before that. What was before? The materialist has a very simple solution to all of these questions. The only thing that really exists is matter. By some mistake, chance, accident, matter became alive. And by another mistake, it started to think and feel. And by a very, very unusual mistake, it became human. But that's just a mistake. There is no soul. We are bones, we have organs, there's a heart and a stomach and a brain and so many things, but there's nothing that survives death because it's all matter. The body is created out of matter, and the body dissolves back into matter, and that's the truth of our being. The only thing that was before our birth was matter, the mud. The only thing afterwards will be the dust. That's the simple answer. We can say there's rebirth in the sense that the dust, the mud, goes and reconstitutes itself and creates some other bodies in the future. We eat other animals or food and plants, and that becomes food for something else. But there's no consciousness that can survive. There's no life that can survive, and there's no meaning that can survive. That's the materialist view. Materialist view cannot explain love, consciousness, meaning. It can't explain how we feel like we're people. It can't explain how we have a sense of identity. Can't explain any of the things that really make us human. What does Sri Aurobindo say? Sri Aurobindo says, if the spirit has really become the universe, everything must have a meaning. Nothing can be meaningless. Birth must have a meaning. Death must have a meaning. It's not like the divine creates something wonderful called birth and then something to cancel it called death. It's not like that. Everything has a meaning. If we are going through rebirth, there must be a reason for that. There must be a reason that is the divine purpose. Not just a purpose for us, the purpose for the divine. The individual is the key to the whole universe. The individual is the key to the significance of the whole cosmos. We think God is the answer to everything, and that's very true. But the answer is the God that's trying to manifest in the universe through us. The God we're waiting for to come in the door or come down from heaven is supposed to come out from inside. And that is why we're here. And that is the importance that rebirth has. Rebirth is indispensable for the progress of the individual and the progress of the universe. He says it's the only possible way in which the spirit which has been buried, involved in the inconscient, can come out and reveal itself. Because having gone and buried itself in the involution, in the inconscient, there's a process by which it's awakening and trying to come out. And that process is true not only for the universe, it's true for each of us. We are the divine involved and buried, hidden from itself, as our true soul is hidden from our ego, and trying to come to the surface. We're here. Our life is a process of self-discovery. Our life is here for us to discover our true self, not the ego on the surface, not the birthing. And everything that happens to us in the life, in the death, in between, afterwards, is part of that process of spiritual awakening. He says the universe is a self-creative process of a supreme reality. Big word. There's a supreme reality. There's only one reality, and it's divine. And that divine has become the universe. And that it has become all that we see, and that divine is evolving and revealing itself progressively, or discovering itself progressively, and that's us. We are that divine in the process of that self-discovery. And that spirit is there in everything, in all of us and in everything, because there's nothing else. The substance of everything is that spirit unfolding. Every power in the universe. Yes, Ashok, we hear you. Please go ahead.
You kind of intrigued me a little by saying that the divine himself tempted Savitri with the offer of life in the heavens, something like that. I can understand if the devil tempts Savitri like that, but why would the divine himself want to tempt Savitri like that? It looks like he is opposed to the differentiation of his own creation, which is not consistent with what I understand of him.
Great. Very good. Wonderful question. Actually, to be a little more precise than my first time around, Savitri is in dialogue with death. Her whole pursuit is death is trying to convince her to give up the world, to give up love, first to give up Satyavan. And when she can't convince her to anything else, he finally offers her a bribe. Okay, you want Satyavan so much, I'll give you Satyavan, but you can't have him on earth. You can have him in heaven. But I'll give you everything you want in the heavens for a glorious eternity. And she refuses. And at that point of total frustration, when all of death's tricks, fears, all the weapons in his arsenal have failed, death himself disappears and reveals itself as divine being. But this is not the real ultimate divine being. This is a face of the divine. Instead of giving the face of death, he's giving the face of being a sweet, benevolent, divine spirit, but essentially saying the same thing. That is, your fulfillment can be in the worlds beyond, not in life, not on earth. She recognizes that whether it comes as a grimacing, frightening figure of mask of death, or a sweet, sweet, benevolent, divine, godlike being, neither of them are the real truth of reality. Many of the rishis have seen the sweet side and mistaken it and accepted the promise of moksha. But that's not the true ultimate spirit. That's another face or illusion or mask of the truth. The real truth is that ultimate reality that's become the universe and is evolving to manifest itself in the universe. The temptation of mind is so great to consider the divine is separate from the world, that even when we have a high spiritual realization, we think the divine is somewhere else. Shankara made that mistake. We talk about Shankara's mistake, but how many people have discovered moksha, Brahman? It's easy for us to say he made a mistake. But how many, you have to be, how many people have had that discovery so they can make a mistake about it? It's fine to say that Buddha made a mistake and he thought that the only thing we should have is liberation. It's the greatest, maybe Sri Aurobindo says he's the greatest personality that ever walked on earth. But he did make a mistake. Rather, he didn't see the whole truth. And that's symbolized in the story by death's disappearance, the divine appearing, and again telling Savitri or showing Savitri a half-truth. Because the whole of humanity over thousands of years has not seen the whole truth. Sri Aurobindo has come to announce a truth which Shankara didn't see. He saw Brahman, which Buddha didn't see. He saw nirvana and an endless peace, which all the great rishis didn't see because they thought ultimately the answer is somewhere else. And Sri Aurobindo says, this is it. This is heaven. This is the divine. This is why we're here. And that dialogue, that confrontation between love and death is the ultimate affirmation to say, the whole truth and ultimate reality is here. Here on earth, here in the universe, here in our own being, because we are one with that reality. The answer is not to get go out the back door or find an escape. And the story very dramatically illustrates that. It's not the full vision. So many people have had visions of the divine, visions of the gods, have had blissful experiences which far go beyond anything that we have had. But they've been partial experiences. And Sri Aurobindo's trying to tell us, don't stop in the middle. No matter how great, have all experiences. Discover one. You can have nirvana. You can have moksha. Nothing wrong with discovering the transcendent, discover the universal, discover the soul, but don't stop in the middle because it's not the end of the story. Don't go and marry Wickham. Don't settle for Collins. Don't think don't settle for anything less than the whole truth. And the whole truth is to discover the divinity of everything. So, yes.
Another point where I am not fully satisfied is this point that you have made. The soul takes birth in a human body to gain experiences and thereby grow. You see, that may apply to people who accomplish something great and who have remarkable experiences in their life. I refer to people, great leaders, great scientists, great artists like that who are out of the ordinary and who achieve something singular in their life.
Yes.
There it can be meaningful when you say the soul benefited from this experience, that experience, and it developed and it progressed, something like that. For the majority of people who lead a very routine, mundane life, I don't see what great growth or progress the soul makes by living out its life in these very ordinary, uneventful bodies. I don't see any difference from the day-to-day life of these people. Every day they get up and go to work, come back, take their meal and watch TV and then go to bed. It's a very ordinary, routine, uneventful life. What can the soul benefit out of this routine, colorless life?
Great. I'm really glad you asked that question, because that's the only meaningful question. To me, that's the most meaningful question that we should all ask about this chapter. That's the whole thing. We say that a man who has earned $1 billion or a Steve Jobs or whoever it is, or become a prime minister or something, okay, they have accomplished something great. What did they accomplish? You may be right. I think Churchill did accomplish something great. But not because he was prime minister, not because he's read in the history books and we remember his name. If a great individual has done something that's socially great, like earning billions of dollars or founding a nation or something like that, we say that's great. Or winning Wimbledon or whatever is our measure, being a famous actor or actress, we say society says those things are great. What is greatness? What is it we should value? You say for most people you don't see that they're making any progress at all. Well, I suppose it's fair to say in one sense that for most of the things we're doing, we're not making all the progress we can make and should be making. And that's the right question for us to ask. Presumably we're making some progress. If you take our characters in the story, you see that Charlotte decided to marry the first man who proposed to her because she was thinking she wouldn't get anything better. Socially, she's a success. But spiritually, what progress did she make? We reflect on what Charlotte did and we say, you see, Charlotte had goodwill for Lizzie. How can a 27-year-old unmarried girl who has no hope of getting married and no dowry be worried about whether Lizzie and Jane get married? She must be good. And her goodness made her the first one to be married. She may never have realized why she got married, why Collins came to her. But we realize it was her goodness. Her ego may not have realized that, but her soul would realize that. And her soul would have discovered what it's very difficult for any of us to discover, that the real key to our progress is wanting the fulfillment and happiness and progress of everybody else. And in the measure she discovered that, her soul discovered that, she's made a profound progress in life. She's discovered that goodness is divine. And every opportunity, every situation that comes to us, not one or two, Every time we hear a news about somebody else's progress or good fortune or success, we have an opportunity to be good. Not in our behavior, in our emotion. We have an opportunity to remind ourselves that somebody else's joy, somebody else's happiness, even if we see somebody dancing or laughing on the street, is good. Joy is good. Happiness is good. Wherever it is. We have that opportunity every day of our lives in small things and big things. We see somebody enjoying the burfi. As I wish I had that burfi, they're having the burfi. We have an opportunity to be good in our emotion. And instead of where can I get the burfi, who can I give the burfi to? We have an opportunity to be good at every moment in our thoughts, in our feelings, in our actions. She made her progress, we can say, unconsciously. But what about Darcy? Darcy thought he was good. He thought he's very proud of his importance, his money. He should not contaminate himself by mingling with these low people and everything. She said, you're the last man. You're just the last man I would ever marry. You're so objectionable. And what did he do? It's a bitter lesson, but there's a truth in it. I have been selfish all my life. I have been thinking of myself, not of other people. And he did make a progress. He gave up the pride of his self-importance. How many of us can give up the pride of our self-importance? Supposing a PhD is there, and he has the possibility of giving PhD to everybody. If everybody has PhD, then what is my PhD worth? I think I might have mentioned Vijaya and I, when we were working in the company, this was in 2000, this was at the beginning of the cell phone. The CEO of the company had two cell phones. He was so proud. He's walking everywhere with two cell phones in his and talking on one or talking on the other. And I say, I think all your salespeople need to have cell phones. All your editorial people. What? You want all the salespeople to have cell phones? You want the editors to have cell phones? I said, I think everybody should have a cell phone. He felt like we were asking him to give away all of his money. Because cell phone for him was his prestige. How many of us can give up? How much? If I get a car, if I've struggled all my life to get a car or a big house, can I pray that every day everybody else should get cars too? What's the value of my car if everybody has one? So Darcy did make a progress. We can say he made a conscious progress. He made a progress because he wanted Elizabeth. After getting Elizabeth, would he continue to make progress or not is the question. Maybe he was not that conscious. Maybe he'd begin to behave in the same old way and, okay, enough is enough. I have gone and married that terrible lady, Lydia, and made Wickham my... But that doesn't mean I have to invite them to Pemberley. Enough of this humility and humiliation. Let me go back to my self-importance. We have the opportunity at every minute to give up the vanity of self-importance, whether it's of wealth or position or we think we're intelligent or we think we come from a special caste or a special anything. Or my great-great-grandfather was very famous and therefore that makes me famous in some respect, or Nehru once visited the house where I'm living now, and that makes me valuable. We're geniuses at finding ways to make ourselves important. So we each have an opportunity at every day in different situations. But that's not all. Think about Lizzie. When she's got heaven offered to her, when Pemberley's offered to her, when she goes there and really feels, okay, this is really what I want, I want him, I want Pemberling. And just at the moment when she thinks it's going to come, it gets pulled away from her, and the whole world is lost. Everything, it's hopeless. She's very sure. Wickham will never marry Lydia. If Wickham doesn't marry Lydia, none of us can ever get married. Darcy, who has just walked out the door, I will never see him again. But we know what happens. What is the progress for the soul when you go through the terrible trauma of feeling all is lost and miraculously all comes back again? What does it tell us? Don't rely on physical appearances. Nothing. Nothing is hopeless. There is nothing ever hopeless. She was not religious. She didn't pray to mother. But if a mother's devotee is in that situation where it looks totally desperate and she prays and the situation reverses, she makes a spiritual progress. The marriage in Pemberley is a secondary. The really valuable thing is to know there is never anything hopeless. Because life is spirit. Because mother is there. Because grace is there in any situation. We've all seen it. Every devotee has seen it. A situation or a health problem looks to be completely insoluble. It's a fatal disease or something like that. And a prayer to mother and it's cured. We think the cure, oh, I'm very glad that mother has cured. But the really valuable thing is not the cure. The really valuable thing is the progress in consciousness to know body is only an instrument. This mother can cure any disease. If I get lose my job and pray to mother and I get another job or a better job, oh, I got my job. It's not the job that's valuable. That's the peel of the banana. The really valuable thing is mother can give a job. Mother can cure a disease. Spirit is there in everything. What looks to be hopeless is never hopeless. There can never be a hopeless case because everything is a manifestation of spirit. So every day of our lives, in big things and in small things, we're going after the results. We're going after the burfi or the job or curing my illness or marriage or something like that. But even in that process of going after those things which the ego wants, for the soul, it's been married 100,000 times already, and it knows both sides of the process. What's valuable is what the soul is going to learn from this experience. And the soul learns when it sees the spirit in life, when it sees mother's hand, when it knows that grace can act in any situation. And that's the value for us. When it learns the value of goodness, when it learns that even if I'm a soul person in the world, I can make a difference. I can change the world. If Steve Jobs made a progress, I assume he made some progress in this life, it's not because he created the most valuable company in the history of the world. It's not because he's known, his name is known by billions of people. It's not because he sold so many iPods and iPads. It's because he discovered one individual can change the world. He changed it in terms of technology. Winston Churchill became Sri Aurobindo's instrument to defeat Hitler and Nazism. Gandhiji showed that without violence you can get freedom. It may have been foolish. It may have had its other problems. But still, he showed that by calling the people out not to fight, by calling them out to make salt, he could show the power of the word or the power of the idea. The great gain for Mr. Bennett was not that he got the three daughters married. He got it by a high ideal of being responsible. Okay, I did a foolish thing. I sent her to Brighton. She's my daughter. Her marriage is essential, even if she's ruined the family. I have to pay for it. I have to be responsible. And what did he learn? He learned a very powerful lesson, great lesson. If I am responsible, I will have power in life. I cannot accomplish in life without a sense of being responsible for what is really, that's what Abba says, consciousness responsibility. The greater the thing we're willing to say, that's not my responsibility, that's his problem. He got into the problem, he foolishly lent the money, she foolishly went on that holiday, somebody else abused their boss and lost their job, my children are not listening to me, I can't be responsible. We have 1,000 excuses for why we're not responsible for anything that happens. But progress for the soul is to take responsibility for what other people do. Not for what we do, just what we do. So that's why I said, Ashok, your question is, there's no more valuable question as far as I'm concerned for us to ask ourselves in the story, in our lives, what is the progress my soul came for? He says this is an adventure of evolution of consciousness. And what is evolution of consciousness? It's an evolution to knowledge. So what is the knowledge that we're to learn? Not what they're teaching in the schools, for sure. That's not what he means by knowledge. He says contradictions are compliments. What does it mean? That man is tormenting me. My wife is finally quarreling with me and finding fault with me at every minute. I made a terrible mistake by this marriage. To understand that man who's harassing me, the person who's my enemy, the situation which is giving me so much of trouble, is really coming only for my spiritual progress. There's a great truth that I should learn from that. That's knowledge. That's knowledge. Every problem that comes to us, which we don't know how to solve, is a problem that offers us a knowledge. We see it in Sherlock Holmes. We also see it in Sambhu. He falls in love with this young lady who is very nice to him, and suddenly she disappears, and he feels heartbroken. Where did she go? How did she disappear? And then he goes to the train station one day and he sees her sitting on the train about to leave town with a suitcase. And he runs after her because he's deeply in love. He thinks he is. He's so flattered by her attentions. And he wants to take her off the train. No, 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 you must come. So he grabs her bag and insists on pulling her off the train. She won't go, and he falls off the train with the suitcase. And while he's falling down, there's a man standing nearby with a beard. And to catch himself and prevent himself from falling, he grabs the man's beard. And the beard comes off. And he recognized this is the old manager of the bank where he worked who had stole a few lakhs of rupees. And the money that's been stolen from so many places was in that suitcase. This is how we learn. And the police come, and Gopal, Inspector Gopal, comes and congratulates him for catching two thieves and solving so many things at the same time. And this is how we're learning in life. But there's so much of knowledge there in everything that happens to us at every minute. And knowledge is only one part of it. Darcy learns about the truth of power, not the power of his money, the power of his sincerity. Power is divine. Mr. Bennett learns about the power of being responsible. He hasn't done anything. He simply says, I have to pay back all of that money. It will take me years. I think we'll starve to death. I will certainly lose a lot of weight. And three girls are married and without spending any money. He learns the power of sincerity. Love, goodwill. And what is the ultimate lesson that we're supposed to learn? Delight. That everything really is concealed in everything is a delight. And if we're feeling only the pain of it now, it's the ego that's feeling the pain. And the whole reason for the pain is to get us to go out of the ego, to get us to really move from the ego to the psychic, from the soul. So we have opportunities every day, not just to succeed in life. For us, success is good, failure is terrible. Nothing the ego, if I lose an argument, if I say something and my wife proves me it was a foolish thing to say, or my friend shows me that I'm uninformed, I feel sorry and ashamed. For the ego, success is good, failure is bad. For the soul, Darcy's failure in his first proposal is his great success. It's his great opportunity. And when Wickham and Lydia elope and Lizzie feels all is lost, it's her greatest moment in life to know that what can happen. And when Mr. Bennett feels it's all lost and he has to spend the rest of his life for a silly mistake he made of sending her to Brighton, to know in a moment of sincerity, the whole thing can change. Sri Aurobindo doesn't say that it's wrong to get a good job, or it's wrong to have good marriages, or it's wrong to get to earn money or have a house or a car or anything. It's fine. Do it all. But what is the real value? Don't throw away the fruit and keep the peel. If you have the peel, it's fine, but get the fruit. The fruit is the consciousness, the knowledge, the joy, the power, the aspiration, the sincerity that comes. And that's what the soul is mining and getting everywhere. The ego's getting the banana peel. The soul is getting the fruit. And after each birth, it goes and spends time consuming the fruit and trying to get the consciousness out of our life experience. But Sambhu's great, he succeeds, but there's no great virtue in being a Sambhu. No? We can laugh at it and enjoy it, and he's entertaining for us. But why shouldn't we get the full value out of every experience, and not be stumbling around and just accidentally pulling a beard or here and there as we go. That is to get consciousness out of it. Shall I proceed, or is there a further question, Ashok? Because your question, as far as I'm concerned, is the most valuable thing here.
Okay, Gary, I am pretty satisfied.
Great. So, I'm summarizing now. In another 15, 20 minutes, Chandrasekhar is going to share with us stories about rebirth from Mother's Agenda and other places, so you can really hear something about goes beyond the chapter, and then we'll have some more time for questions at the end. But I'm summarizing what we've said so far. What we know he's told us so far, but I'm trying to be sure the connection is clear. This universe is a manifestation of a supreme reality. The supreme reality has not created something there. It has become everything. And it has done that by plunging in to what he calls an inconscient, an involution in which the spirit is concealed in everything. And through ages of evolution, the spirit is manifesting, evolving. How is it evolving? The spirit concealed in matter reveals itself as living things. The spirit concealed in life forms reveals itself as mentally conscious animals and then human beings. And now we're at the stage where the spirit that's still concealed, still involved and buried in us can reveal itself, and we can discover ourselves as spiritual beings. That we are really evolving souls. We are here to manifest that universal and transcendent spirit. Each of us is a center of manifestation of that. Our progress is its progress. Our manifestation is its manifestation. And for that purpose, rebirth is essential. In each birth, the soul is gaining experience. The soul is awakening progressively in consciousness. It's going off, and he's going to talk about this in the next two chapters in more detail. It goes off to assimilate the experience it's acquired during the lifetime and comes back again in new circumstances, new conditions, not Gary and Vani and Ashok and not like that. Not the same ego, the same psychic, whether Sambhu came back as Sherlock Holmes or Sherlock Holmes came back as Sambhu and all of that, I won't speculate on. We judge somebody's very intelligent, somebody's not. Somebody's very successful, somebody's not. Somebody's poor, somebody's rich. And we mistake all of these outer things. He's a chief minister, so he must be very evolved. He's a poor farmer taking care of 20 family members, so he must be something else. That's all social. We are each a soul making progress in different ways at different levels through different experiences. Through the same process, our goal, our purpose is not to judge anybody. If we want to judge anybody, the only right judgment is to know that person is also the divine, that person is also a soul. Whether he's my friend or my enemy, whether he's doing what I like or doing the opposite, is different. I'm here. What's the progress I should make at each moment? The awakening of the spirit only comes through the individual. And the awakening of the individual only comes by our outgrowing the ego and discovering the spirit in ourselves and the spirit in others, and eventually the spirit that's transcendent of the universe, and discovering it's the same spirit in it all. So what's the significance of the individual? He says the individual is not an accident, which is what science says. It's not a one-time error, like Christianity says. It's not an illusion, like Buddhism says. Mayavada says. It's not a wheel of suffering like Buddhism says. The individual is eternal. It's not just a question we're going to be reborn. The truth of our being is something that's eternal. Whether it's born or not, whether we take birth or not, we are the eternal spirit. We think of ourselves temporary. I've lived so many years and I only have a few years left. Okay, you give me a consolation and say it's not my last. If I don't get the burfi this time, I can get it in the next life. But that's not what he says. That which was born is eternal. Eternal means how old is it? How long has it been around? How many births? Something that's eternal has no beginning. He says if something has a beginning, it has an end. When we say something's eternal, we mean it has no beginning. No beginning. Not that it's been around a long time. It has no beginning and it has no end. And that's us. Whether the scientists are right about a Big Bang and the end of the universe or not, they're not right about us. We didn't have a beginning. We don't have an end, because the truth of our being is eternal, and eternal means immortal. But what Sri Aurobindo says is that immortality the Vedic rishis knew. The Vedic rishis discovered so many thousands of years ago that the truth of our being is an immortal soul. But that's not the immortality he's talking about. The truth of our being is that our destiny is to be immortal in life, in on earth, in the body. Immortal, at least, to have that choice for as long as we want it. There has always been the immortal spirit, but this universe has been created so that the spirit can create a creation that is also immortal. Doesn't mean immortally the same, that we have to wear the same sari every day for the rest of creation, or eat the same sweets every time. That's not what he means. We can continue to evolve. We can continue to discover. We can continue to manifest infinitely, because we're not only immortal, we're infinite. And we have an infinite number of spiritual experiences and spiritual qualities to experience. But the question of running out of time simply doesn't arise, because our truth is not in time. This is the significance of the universe. This is the significance of the soul. This is the significance of the individual. This is the significance of our birth. This is the significance of our body. Because he says, it's the first time I read it. I had missed it. He must have been saying it so many times, but I missed it. We only make progress when we're in the body. It sounds like it's pretty good. After the soul leaves the body, it can go and live in the higher worlds and all. It's pretty blissful. There's nobody bothering you. You never get hungry and all of those things. All the real progress of the soul is in the body. This is where we evolve spiritually. So that's not only the significance of the individual, the significance of our life, the significance of the body, and incidentally, what distinguishes the human from everything else in the universe, meaning from the gods, which Sri Aurobindo and Mother have said. The gods don't evolve. The gods can't evolve. If the gods want to evolve, they've got to take bodies. They've got to come and be born on earth and all, because it's the only way anything can make a progress. So what have we left out? What is left out of his equation? Why we are born, even why we die, which he has explained elsewhere. He says death is not the opposite of life. Death is a process of life, because if you leave it to me, I'll be doing one thing over and over again. I'll be learning one lesson. And at the end of my soul will finally say, this guy, the only lesson he's learning, he keeps repeating himself. I need a new birth for a new lesson. Death is to free us from the limitation of our habits. It's not an end of anything. It's not an end of life for us. It's not an end of progress for us. It only means we've exhausted our capacity of the surface personality for progress in this body, in this birth, in this life. And if we want to hang around a little longer, don't exhaust it. There's plenty more to learn. There's plenty more knowledge. There's plenty more joy. There's plenty more goodness. There's plenty more truth. There's plenty more power. We can learn it every minute. Let's make use of every moment to make the maximum progress in the conditions that Mother has given us. When we say the spirit has become the world, he means Satchitananda has become the universe. And when he says Satchitananda is evolving spiritual evolution, he means Satchitananda, which has become the universe, is revealing itself in the universe. And Satchidananda means infinite existence, eternal existence, infinite consciousness, which incidentally means infinite power, infinite beauty, love, and joy. So our evolution is to discover that in ourselves, not just in me or you, in all, in everything, in everything. So I don't think any of us feel we are at the end of the journey. If we wake up in the morning and you feel that you're Satchidananda, and more importantly, if you feel everybody else is Satchidananda, and life is Satchidananda, and everything around you is Satchidananda, well, I congratulate you. And if it's not just for an instant, if it's for an hour or a day, so we are, after all of these births, I think we still have a long way to go. There's a lot more to discover. We're just at the beginning of this adventure. All progress, he says, depends on two things. The sincerity of the call from the soul below, the evolving soul, and the response of the grace. The ascending aspiration and the descending grace. Dawn comes as that promise. Dawn is that flash for that instant at the sunrise of what's to come. It's there for a second and then it vanishes and we see the ordinary life. And if we get that hint of joy or truth even for a second and then it vanishes, that's how it is for us too. It's an everlasting day. The beginning of Savitri is the symbol dawn. The last canto is the everlasting day. The everlasting day where every moment is eternity. Every moment is the beauty and the delight and the love and the truth and the power of Satchidananda. So we've got a lot to live for and look forward to. And Sri Aurobindo says, if humanity knew, if we had any idea what was waiting for us, if we had any idea what was waiting for us, we would drop everything and rush towards it, which is a polite way of saying you all have no idea because you seem to be quite content with what you have, thinking that we've arrived at something when this is the first ray of dawn, when the everlasting day is waiting for us. So what are we wasting time? So he raises a number of questions, and maybe Chandru will come back to a few of these, but just some factual things that come out in the chapter, which I wasn't sure about before. He says, he raises questions of tradition. In some of the traditions, they say that if you don't do the right thing in this life, you'll be reborn as an animal, goat or something like that, whatever. He says, all of us have come from all the lower forms. Our soul, each soul, starts as a spark in matter, in life, in the early lower levels of life, and finally the soul has evolved to the point of the human life. He says, it's theoretically not impossible for the human soul to go back to an animal for the simple reason that nothing is impossible for the divine. But that would be a very, very rare exception. And there's an interesting paragraph. He says, there are some human beings who are really borderline cases. They just seem to be on the border between the animal. And one of them he mentions very significantly is the American gangster. So beware of the American gangster or the gangster. He talks about the Parisian criminal. I think we have them all over the world in different disguises. There are humans that are just on the borderline. Maybe the soul will feel I better go back and get a little more experience to outgrow the joy of devouring somebody else. But generally speaking, this idea that you better behave yourself or next time you'll be a wolf or a fox or a rabbit or generally it's just a superstition, he says. Once we reach the human stage, and he gave us a compliment. I felt very complimented and proud at that moment because he says the distance between the human and the animal is as great as between the animal and the plant. I felt really happy to hear that because he's also told us earlier that the distance between man and Superman is similar to the distance between man and the ape. So I thought we're closer to the ape than we are to Superman. But anyway, he's given us a compliment and say we've come a long way and to be where we are. The question is, let's not waste all climbing all the way to the top of this that we've come. Let's make the most of it to go. This is really the beginning. This is not the end of the journey. I think I have 2 more minutes. I'm going to turn this over to Chandrasekhar. I'm just seeing if I've missed anything essential. Why the succession of rebirths? We are the infinite, concealed from ourselves, trying to rediscover ourselves. How long does it take for the infinite to rediscover ourselves? If we're only looking for a burfi or a banana, it shouldn't take long. What the surprise that's waiting for us, the mystery that's waiting for us is infinite. It's an infinite being, consciousness, ananda. Therefore, it can take some time for us to discover that infinity. The point is not how many births that take us. The question is, how much are we discovering in this birth? How much are we discovering every minute? We're not going to exhaust the mystery. We're not going to exhaust the wonder. And I must say, Mani can confirm it because she's on the nightly calls. And Chandrasekhar is also. Janani, when we started reading Sambhu, I wondered, why is Appa talking about the Sambhu? It's all very amusing and all, but why, what is he, why are we doing this? It seems to be silly stories. I'm discovering things about life divine and about life through Sambhu that I have not understood through anything else. And I realized because what Sambhu really shows us is I'm so conscious of what we do and what happens. We think we have to do this. That's the ego. We have to do this and this will happen. And when I realized the most important things in my life didn't happen because I did anything. For Sambhu, he's falling down and he grabs the lamppost or the post and the post falls down and breaks and he discovers the hidden diamonds. For me, I walked into a bookstore and a book fell off the shelf and it changed my life. It's not I who did something. So the more what Sambhu shows is the real mystery of our life is not about what we do, but about what happens to us and how that life responds to us. That's why Appa's insistence on life response is everything. It's not our aspiration is important, but the response of grace is the real mystery. Our attitude, our sincerity, our goodness, our goodwill is important, but it's the response of everything around us. It's an infinite mystery. We can never exhaust it. And that's what we're here for. That's the adventure of consciousness and joy. So I'll turn the meeting over to Chandrasekharan to speak with us, and then we'll come back for a few minutes at the end if there's any questions or anything to discuss. Chandru?
Good evening. I have collected a few interesting thoughts, questions and answers, and stories about rebirth from Sri Aurobindo's books on the Mother's Agenda. I would like to share them with you now. The evolution is a truth. To scientists, The physical evolution of species is the only truth. To us, the devotees, evolution of everything is the truth. If evolution of consciousness is true, then individual must evolve, grow, and develop until he reaches perfect consciousness. This is not possible in a brief, single human life. It is because in each birth, an individual comes with just one major vibration and a few minor vibrations that support the major one. The experience of one major vibration of consciousness can never be called the whole or perfect. If there is the evolution of a conscious individual, then there must be rebirth. Not one rebirth. We need many, many rebirths so that we can have all types of experiences and evolve. To take a rebirth, the psychic being must leave a body. What happens to the various parts of a man when a psychic being leaves the body? When the evolving soul, the psychic being, departs the body, usually it goes out through the head in a subtle body. Then the man's body begins to dissolve. When the body is dissolved, the vital being goes into the vital plane and remains there for some time. Then the vital sheath disappears. The last to dissolve is mental sheath. It dissolves just like the vital sheath. The evolving soul or psychic being does not dissolve. It retires into a psychic world. It rests in that world until it decides to take a new birth. This is the general course for ordinarily developed men and women. But there can be many variations according to the nature, strengths, and development of the human beings. If the mental being, for example, if the mental being is strongly developed and relies on the psychic being only, then the mental being can share the immortality of the psychic being. The psychic being gathers the essence, the essential elements of its experience in a birth, and makes its basis of growth in its evolution. When it takes a new birth, it takes up new mental, vital, and physical sheets along with past karma to the extent they are helpful in the new life for further experience and evolution. Each time the psychic being takes rebirth, a new mind, life, and body are formed out of the materials of the universal nature according to the soul's past evolution and its needs for the future. So what happens to your psychic being when it leaves the body? After leaving the body, the psychic being does not directly go to the psychic world. There are many worlds between the physical, material world and the psychic world. The psychic being does go through these worlds also and gather experiences and then retires into the psychic world. The psychic being first goes to vital world, which is very dangerous and painful. After living in the vital world for some time and gathering experiences, it travels through other worlds until it reaches the psychic world. Only travel through the vital plane is difficult and painful. While resting in the psychic world, it assimilates all the essence of its experiences and then determines the circumstances of a new birth and the details of a new body, vital, and mind. The departed psychic being retains the past experiences only in true essence, not in the form of details. When one gets a new body, the nature which inhabits it, nature of mind, nature of vital, nature of physical, is made up of many personalities, not one simple personality, although there is one central being. This complex personality is formed partly by bringing together personalities of past lives, and also by gathering experiences, tendencies, influences from the earth atmosphere. In the new birth, only by yoga drishti, these memories can be recalled, either in essence or in details. But in some cases, if the person has a very strong shock or experience, he or she may be able to recall a few of the past memories, even without yoga drishti. Is there a hell? Is there a heaven? Does a psychic being go through hell or heaven, depending on a man's deeds in this life? The movement of the psychic being, dropping the outer sheets on its way to the psychic plane, is the normal movement. Its travel through many other planes is also a normal movement. There can be many variations. One can return from the vital plane and imagine he was in hell. If a psychic being suddenly and quickly returns from the vital plane and takes rebirth, it remembers its experience in the vital world and it assumes because it had been in hell. Some strong souls that had positive experiences in vital world believe they had been in heaven. Hell and heaven are often imaginary states of the soul or of the vital being which it constructs about it after its passing through the planes. What is meant by hell is a painful passage through the vital plane or lingering there, where one remains surrounded by the forces of suffering and turmoil. There are also worlds of mind and vital worlds which are penetrated with joyful experiences, and generally it is assumed to be heaven. One may pass through these as a result of things formed in the nature which create the necessary affinities. But the idea of reward or retribution is a crude conception which is erroneous. How can we help a soul that has departed in its journey to the psychic world and in its rebirth? If one has occult knowledge, one can act on the basis of that knowledge and help the departed soul. But most of us don't have that type of knowledge. It is always possible to help departed souls in their passage if one has the necessary psychic feeling towards them and the psychic force to make it effective. When we do not have occult or psychic force, what we can do is to give our goodwill to the soul. We should not feel sad or sorrowful, though it is difficult to control such feelings. If we are sorrowful, we are holding back the soul and keeping it attached to our human world and delaying its journey to the psychic world and its rebirth. Leaving, shedding of the body is not a cessation of their personal existence. A man is not dead because he goes into another country and changes his dress to suit the climate. When a man takes rebirth, his life is prosperous or sorrowful, depending on the punyam or pavam, the good deeds or bad deeds in his past lives. Is there any truth in this statement? Theory of karma and the results of past accumulated energies are very complex to be explained in a simple sentence or a paragraph. The ordinary theories on the idea of punyam and pavam and their results in the next life are too mechanical. There are certainly results of karma and the energies put forth in a past life, but not on that simple childish principle. According to the traditional orthodox theory, a good man suffering in this life would be a proof that he had been a notorious villain in his past life. A bad man's prosperity would be a proof that he had been quite good in his last visit to earth to reap this bumper crop of good fortune. These ideas are too symmetrical to be true. The object of birth being growth by experience, whatever reactions come to past deeds must be for the being to learn and grow, not as lollipops or sweets for good boys of the class in the past and beatings and cannings for the bad ones. The psychic being needs all types of experiences. The real sanction for good or ill is not good fortune for the one and bad fortune for the other. It is said that the psychic being reviews the life at the time of leaving body. Does the psychic being take a decision about rebirth at the time of leaving the body? The psychic being's choice at the time of leaving a body does not work out the next formation of personality. It only fixes it. Fixation means an obsessive interest in or feeling about someone or something. Formation means the process or act of giving a concrete form to the interest, the fixation. I want to have chapati for dinner. That is fixation. When I buy chapati from a restaurant or make it myself, there is formation based on my fixation. When the psychic being enters the psychic world, it begins to assimilate the essence of its experience, and by that assimilation is formed the future psychic personality in accordance with the fixation already made at the time of leaving body. When this assimilation is over, it is ready for a new birth. For example, a psychic being may want to be rich in the next birth. It is fixation. The psychic being does not decide whether it will be born as the son of a rich American businessman or a rich Indian industrialist, or it will earn its own fortune. All those details will be worked out when the assimilation is over and the psychic being is ready for a new birth. Does the psychic being have the power to work out the formation all by itself? I want to have chapati for dinner. If I have money and I know where I can buy it from, I can have it tonight. But I do not know how to make chapati at home, so my capacity is limited. Even if I know where to buy from, the restaurant may be closed. If the restaurant is closed, either I will have to wait till next morning, or I can request my daughter or wife to make it. My daughter or wife know how to make chapati and also know where to buy it from. They do not depend on others to have a delicious dinner, whereas I do. There may be people who may not know where to buy from or how to make anything. They may have to depend on others for everything. Some psychic beings are fully developed. Some are less developed. Some are infants. The fully developed psychic beings may be able to do what they want all by themselves. The less developed beings do not work out the whole thing for themselves. There are beings and forces. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Can I interrupt you with a question?
Yes, sir.
We say that when a person is born, his soul has taken a birth in a body for a certain purpose. When you see a baby dying even before it has reached its first birthday, it seems to be a life totally wasted. Why would a soul be born in a body that loses its life before its first birthday? It seems to be a useless attempt. Conflicts with the theoretical position we take that the soul takes birth in a body for a certain purpose. See their life coming to an end in less than a year. It seems to be a wrong initiative, or almost a useless initiative on the part of the soul to take this kind of birth. What do you say for this?
So the soul of the psychic being needs all types of experiences. It is quite possible that this psychic being may have lived for 100 years or 150 years in a previous birth. And it may be interested in knowing what it would be like to live for a month or a year. So it is an opposite experience. So when it has opposite experiences, I think its experience becomes complete.
This is your understanding?
This is my understanding, sir. When we talk about transformation, we have to do something just opposite to our nature or character. By doing so, yes, sir. Someone?
I just wanted to add one possibility. It's a good question, and I liked your answer too. But I just wanted to give one more side of it, and that is, We tend to still think of this as each of us for ourselves. So what did the soul get out of this? But the soul is, this is a play of the infinite with itself. The soul that takes birth for a year is not just having its own experience, it's giving experience to others. And we have to look at the totality of that. We're aware of what I'm thinking about, what experience I'm getting during this life. I'm not thinking about what experience I'm giving to other people and what their progress they're making as a result of that. So I just wanted to point out there's another side to it. We have to look at the whole thing.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, Chandra.
Thank you. How much time does a psychic being take to get ready for a new rebirth? How long does it rest before it takes rebirth? The time depends on the development and on a certain rhythm of the being. It also depends on the fixation. For some, there is practically immediate rebirth. For others, it takes longer. For some, it may take centuries. But again, once the psychic being is sufficiently developed, it is free to choose its own rhythm and its own intervals. The psychic does not give up the mental or other sheets apart from the body, the physical body, immediately at death. It is said that it takes 3 years on the whole to get clear away from the zone of communicability with the earth, though there may be cases of slower or quicker passages. In 1963, a sadhak brought a 7-month-old baby to mother. The baby was looking at others with his soul. When the mother looked at him, his eyes lit up. He did not cry, but he made some sort of noise and stretched his arms to the mother. She took him in her arms and he laid his head on her heart. He did not close his eyes. He became joyful and ecstatic. Then the sadhak took the baby from the mother and put the baby on the floor. As soon as the baby saw the mother's feet, he caught them with his two hands, one hand on each foot. Mother thought the baby could be a great sage in a past life, or perhaps an emanation of Sri Aurobindo. 4 years later, mother saw the child again and discovered he was an Egyptian pharaoh who had lived thousands of years ago. In this case, the psychic being took centuries to take a new rebirth. Sometimes, the psychic being takes rebirth very quickly without spending a long time resting in the psychic plane. In such cases, the psychic being of the newborn baby may have a very strong memories of his recent past life. Perhaps that is the reason why some babies smile or play for reasons not known to people around the baby. When the baby grows, we teach, educate, and train the baby in our way of looking at things and ensure that the psychic memories of the baby fade away. A psychic being left the body of a teenager with a strong fixation that it must live in the same family. Sri Aurobindo took the psychic being and placed it in the same family. Within a year, a child was born in the family with the psychic being. In this case, because of the intervention of Sri Aurobindo, the psychic being took a rebirth very quickly. Is it possible that one who is evil or does many bad deeds in this life is reborn as an animal or tree in next birth? The psychic being. Yes, sir. Tell again. Yes, sir.
I need a clarification over some point I have in mind.
Yes, sir.
Normally, it is said that at the level of the spirit, everybody is equal. But then we hear that the psychic being is evolving type. If it is true that it evolves, then it must be at different evolutionary levels among different people, no?
Yes.
In that case, educated upper class people should have a better formed soul than the working class uneducated people. Whose souls must be somewhat simpler. So if the soul is at a different level among different people, then why is it said that at the level of spirit everybody is equal?
Well, by education, you are talking about social or from human levels.
I mean, academic education that equips the evolving soul with a better mind should make that particular soul be more evolved than an uneducated man, very poor education, no?
No, I don't think so, because Sri Ramakrishna is not educated, sir. Ramakrishna Paramahamsa is an uneducated man. Do you think he is inferior to a professor in a university? I don't think so. Education is
Ramakrishna may be an exception. But if you take an ordinary farm worker with a third standard education, you say that he at the level of the soul is as equal to a
people, uneducated people who are living in villages. They have a better understanding of life than people who are educated and spoiled. That's what I read from Appa's books. And we also hear about westernized Indians who are even more inferior than people who are educated here, for Indianized Indians.
So what is your final pronouncement on this matter?
Are you conceding
that at the spiritual level you are speaking?
The spirit is a substance, sir. It may be equal. But the psychic being, definitely, because Sri Aurobindo says psychic beings have different stages of development, I'll go with what Sri Aurobindo says. I don't have any personal, I have never seen a psychic being or soul. So I try to understand these abstract concepts from what Mother and Sri Aurobindo have written. Only when I have an experience, psychic experience, I'll be able to say anything with authority. Until then, I have to repeat what Sri Aurobindo says.
Would you like to comment?
Well, I like Chandrasekharan's answer very much. And I agree with it. I just add a little. I think one of the points he's making is we should not confuse society's evaluation of a person with spiritual progress. We certainly have enough evidence to know that wealth is not a measure of goodness or knowledge or spirituality. But according to society, wealth is a good measure of importance and value of a person. We certainly can't make that mistake. What Chandra said about education, I can validate it from all my experience because I'm working with some of the most educated people in the world. And we certainly shouldn't mistake education for knowledge. Some of the most educated people, I don't have to finish the sentence. Knowledge, spiritual knowledge, real knowledge, is something very different than education. And some of the people with the highest education have the least knowledge. They're insisting that there's no such thing as anything but matter. I mean, it's hard to be more mistaken about the universe than they are. So I think our tendency to confuse a social evaluation, which is the ego's evaluation, with the spirit's evaluation, is because we still accept the values of the ego rather than the values of the spirit. You remember Appa frequently refers to Sri Aurobindo's aphorism, "I worship the feet of the harlot and the criminal." That it's the great souls who become the harlot and the criminal. Because it's those people who hold the society together. It's those people who help the society evolve. So none of us have the knowledge to pronounce on individuals, but we certainly can understand that the social way of Society doesn't value people according to their truthfulness. Society doesn't value people according to their consciousness. Society doesn't value people according to their knowledge or according to their joy. We have a set of false values, which are the ego's values, which are the values of the ignorance. And when we come away from those values, say, you know, Ashok, Appa discovered the psychic in a servant. And the psychic sweetness in a servant, which he didn't find in anyone else. An uneducated servant, which he didn't find in anyone else. So, who had the joy of service and felt the sweetness of self-giving through everybody she served. So, let's just, I agree with what Chandru said, it's a lot more complex than that. It doesn't mean that there's no relationship in any case between external development and internal development. But, you know, the teacher is not necessarily more intelligent than the student. The teacher came first. The country that became prosperous first is not greater. Britain was once the greatest empire in the world, but where is Britain today? We still cherish the Greek culture of 2,000 years ago, but where is Greece today? It's struggling to pay its bills. We have a certain social hierarchy of things. Today we think America is great. Sherbindo talks about the American gangster who's close to the animal. So we need to think just because something came earlier doesn't mean it's better. And just because something comes later doesn't mean it's lower. The divine is manifesting. The people who follow are as important as the people who came earlier. And more so, it's the people who came earlier who paved the way for. This is an evolving miracle. It's an evolving mystery. And it defies all our simple notions of high or low or good or bad. It's an infinity trying to manifest itself. So it doesn't follow a hierarchical order or a temporal sequence. We can't say, see, there are stories in the Indian tradition about the disciple who's a much greater soul than the guru. Now there, you know, all of the stories like that. So we just have to be aware of the illusion of the appearance. Please go ahead, Chandra.
Is it possible that one who is evil or does many bad deeds in this life is reborn as an animal or tree next birth? The psychic being, if once having reached the human consciousness, cannot go back to the inferior animal consciousness. It doesn't go back into a tree or an insect, though it can do, generally it does not do. But we do share many stories in which sages curse the offenders and the culprits become an animal or tree. Even if we assume these stories to be true, there will not be rebirth of the psychic being in these cases. What happens is a part of the vital personality of the offender disjoints itself and joins an animal birth or tree birth. The psychic being is interested in evolution and progress. It does not look back and go back. It analyzes the past at the time of assimilation of a sense of experiences for taking rebirth to evolve only. So does every human being have a psychic being? All human incarnations or births have a psychic being. It's only other types like the vital beings that don't have psychic being. And that's why they want to possess men and enjoy physical life without being themselves born here. Even gods, the lower mental gods, do not have psychic being. Do we change our sex when we are born again? The words follow usually one line or other and do not alternate. Though there may be purposeful exceptions like Sikandi. I assume you know the story of Sikandi. The central being did not change. The central being was Amba. But she took an outer form, one part of her personality, changed it into that of a man or eunuch, and helped Arjuna kill Bhishma. Thus, relationship of one birth persists in successive births. For example, as sex does not generally change in successive births, will my wife in this life again be my wife in the next birth? I have good news and bad news. The good news is the relationship will not be repeated. The bad news is the same person will often come into your life with a different relationship. So, in any case, you will have to meet your wife or husband in successive births, though the relationship will be different. Repetition of the same relationship in successive births is possible only in rare cases. If your name is Satyavan and your sweetheart's name is Savitri, then the romantic relationship may continue in successive births. It can never be a law. As a rule, the same relationship will not be repeated. If it is done, then how can there be new experiences for the psychic being? But the same individuals meet again and again on the earth in different lives, and the relationship would mostly be different. An individual is a universe. He can express infinite type of relationship and be a source of new experience to the soul. Even in this life, we know that just one person, whether your spouse or son or daughter, can give you new experiences every minute. Do we really need the memories of the past lives when we take new rebirth? The psychic being needs the essences of experiences of the past lives to determine the circumstances of rebirth. That is the only value of the memory of the past lives. Once the psychic being takes rebirth, it is not interested in the past lives because it is interested in future and evolution. Only our human mind, ego, and its curiosity are interested in knowing those details. Generally, there is no use in knowing the details of the past lives. When does a psychic being leave a human being? Generally, the psychic being leaves the body at the time of death, but it may decide otherwise. Even when a man is living, the psychic being may decide to leave his body. It is not a general rule, but it may happen. In 1971, mother saw a young child beside a sadhak. The child was visible only to mother. He was putting his hand on the sadhak's shoulder. The child's eyes were wide open with a sort of devotion and adoration. On inquiry, mother found out that the child was the psychic being of the sadhak's brother. The brother was still living, but he had taken completely a wrong course. The psychic being left him and came to the sadhak in order to live near mother instead of going to the psychic world. It's going to be 7, so I'm skipping some of the stories which I'll share with you in future. Each person follows in the world his own line of destiny, which is determined by his own nature and actions. The meaning and necessity of what happens in a particular life cannot be understood except in the light of the whole course of many lives. But this can be seen by those who can get beyond the ordinary mind and feelings and see things as a whole, that even errors, misfortunes are steps in the journey. We do not know what we were in our past lives. We do not know what we will be in our future lives. But in this life, we have come to the Mother and Sri Aurobindo. This is grace. Let us not worry about past lives or speculate about future lives. Let us consecrate as much as possible in this life to Mother and leave the question of our rebirth to her. Thank you.
I am thanking Mr. Gary and Mr. Chandrasekhar and all the devotees who have attended this session. And now we are closing the session.